Chapter 5. All in the Family. All the Hats. The late 1970s were good times for the Trinchero family. Roger had returned to the winery in 1972 to lead the sales and distribution effort, and to help his brother out with marketing and production. Bob was selling wine to restaurants in San Francisco from the trunk of his 1962 Chrysler. Vera came on board full-time in 1979 to handle the phone orders, billing, and labeling with Bob's wife, Evelyn. After Bob and Roger accidentally designed a label for a fortified Zinfandel wine with desert instead of dessert, "What a couple of dummies," says Bob. Vera, who had inherited her mother's characteristic sharp-mindedness, took over proofreading, label approval, and compliance, too. Vera's teenage sons, Bobby and Tony Torres, worked the bottling line in the warehouse or in the cellar. Bob's young son, David, spent his time after school and on the weekends pushing a broom around the warehouse, and daughter Gina was given the special privilege of daily restroom cleaning. She remembers feeling proud when visitors said the restrooms were the cleanest in the valley. "It's one reason why we think so highly of our employees today," says Evelyn. "There was a time when we handled all the jobs, we wore all the hats." These were also years of transition. Wisely, Mario knew it was time to pass on the company leadership to his sons. Up until now, Mario had been president and Bob vice president. After Roger had been working with him for a while, Bob suggested to his father they make the younger Trinchero brother a vice president. "But you're the vice president," Mario said. Bob replied, "Well, I'm thinking of being president, and you can be chairman of the board, okay?" Just then, Vera, whose business experience Mario trusted, walked in on the conversation. "Vera," he yelled, "who's higher, president or chairman of the board?" She said, "Chairman of the board, Pop." Mario thought for a moment, then said, "Okay, Bob, you can be president." Later, when the new business cards arrived, Mario didn't want them. He had a box and a half left of the old ones, and he sat at his desk with a pen and blackened out the word president before carefully printing COB in its place. With business on the upswing, Mario bought himself a Mercury Cougar. He'd rev the engine up and down Main Street while he took Vera's boys with him to go shopping or to the bank. He also started wearing turtleneck sweaters and a beret to complement his new style. "Grandpa was a lead foot," remembers Tony, laughing. In his later years, Mario slowed down. "We all looked up to him," says David. "When you were the kid who got to sit on his lap, it felt important. In his later years, he didn't always feel like getting up, and all of us grandkids mastered making his martini just the way he liked it." Eventually, Vera's boys and later David and Gina ended up working in the tasting room in the afternoons after high school, which was legal as long as it was a family business and they weren't on the payroll. "The zenith of responsibility for us kids was operating the cash register," remembers Gina. "When the National Minimum Drinking Age Act was passed, we had to ask for ID. College students didn't think it was funny to be carded or cut off by a 14-year-old. By then, Sutter Home had narrowed its wine offerings from 52 down to 3 table wines, as well as small batches of fortified wines, the Amador County Zinfandel, the White Zinfandel, and a sweet Moscato Amable, all poured for visitors in small claret glasses. "I'll never forget the smells in those days," says Bobby. "Uncle Bob was still making vinegar, and so we had a vinegar room, with these 55-gallon drums of onion powder and spices and all these things he was adding. Then you'd walk into the other part of the winery, and you'd smell the wine and the triple cream sherry with its orange peel and cinnamon, and the vermouth, all those family recipes for fortified wine." Anyone who was working at the winery on any given day sat down to eat lunch together. This was true from the family-only days to the time of the very first outside employees, including winemaker Steve Bertolucci and assistant winemaker and future head of vineyard development, Hal Huffsmith. The daily lunches took place in the kitchen behind the tasting room, or occasionally at Mary and Mario's house, the house Bob, Roger, and Vera had grown up in, which sat just 150 feet behind the winery. Despite the proximity, Mario drove himself to the winery every day, even on chilly days when he had to warm up his car, and before noon, he would drive 150 feet back to the house to lay out lunch on the table. He often assembled sandwiches with leftover lamb or sardines. Sometimes he'd make pasta. He'd use fresh fare from his own bountiful garden, too. Not all Mario's gardening adventures were successful. One night, martini in hand, Mario watered his ill-fated prize tomatoes by kicking the hose from plant to plant, not realizing until too late that the hose was hooked up to hot water. Another time, he planted mint for his famous cocktails in the ground, not in containers, and it spread over the lawn like wildfire. "For years, it smelled like mint every time we mowed the lawn," says Roger. At the end of each day, Mario maintained a tradition he'd started back when Bob was handling the tasting room. He'd set a sales goal of $100 for each day, and if Bob and Evelyn met the goal while working in the tasting room, Mario would give them $10 and make them each a martini. But Mario could be strict. Bob remembers one day when he was $2 short of the $100 mark, so Bob actually bought a gallon of his own wine to make it over the threshold to get the $10 he and Evelyn needed. By the 1970s, when White Zin was flying off the shelves, there were large batches of Mario's famous gin and sweet vermouth martinis to go around after the tasting room closed each evening. By the end of the decade, the family was beginning to reap the first financial rewards for their 30 years of hard work. When her boys left for college, Vera tried to send them a little extra on top of tuition each quarter for spending money. In 1978, she surprised Bobby with $500, more money than she'd ever been able to send before. And the following summer, when his old Ford Capri died in a cloud of smoke right outside her office window, she wouldn't let him get it fixed. With her newfound disposable income and the characteristic generosity that would become legendary in Napa Valley, she wrote him a check to buy another used car. Roger's fondest memory of this time is a hot summer night during what turned out to be Mario's final harvest in 1980. The area where the grapes were unloaded and crushed was set up outdoors alongside the winery, right across from Mario and Mary's house. Bob was on the crusher destemmer. I was up on the forklift, and my sister was out there cheering us on, Roger says. I looked over, and Mom and Dad had set up a couple of lawn chairs, and my dad had mixed up a nice batch of martinis. He and Mom were sitting out there drinking martinis and watching all of us crush grapes. I knew in that moment how proud he was that he had done something that his kids could carry on. Legacy assured. On February 3, 1981, Mario Trinchero celebrated his 82nd birthday at Vera's house. Shortly thereafter, doctors diagnosed him with cancer. After 2 weeks of chemotherapy treatments, he left the hospital, but within several days he developed a cold and was readmitted, only to develop pneumonia. On March 28, 1981, Mario died. The day of Mario's funeral was the only time the Trinchero family had ever closed the winery tasting room. Mario would have been shocked. "I can hear him now," says Bob. "You what? You closed up the winery and the tasting room, and you paid everybody?" The loss of Mario devastated his family and Sutter Home, but his children were grateful that he had lived to see the positive results of some of the decisions they'd made. In the year or two before he died, Mario had glimpsed the winery changing from a local mom-and-pop operation into a national brand, a company truly capable of supporting the family into the future. Stop the presses. In 1978, amid the booming success of White Zinfandel, Sutter Home could finally afford Vera Trinquero Torres full-time to handle phone orders, billing, and labeling. When Bob and Roger inadvertently designed a label for fortified Zinfandel with desert wine instead of dessert wine, Vera caught the error and promptly added proofreading, label approval, and compliance to her responsibilities. Vera inherited her mother's sharp mind and spent 24 years working as a legal secretary prior to finally joining the organization in 1978. She is still remembered by employees for her remarkable generosity with employees, commitment to philanthropy within the community, and perfect handwriting.